Good evening. Welcome to the Solera Report. Today is Thursday, April 22nd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, special report tonight, we have money in markets, a lot happening in the markets, and some great questions from you and Ask Catherine. Dr. Catherine Albrecht, the author of Spy Chips, and really one of the, if not the foremost privacy expert in America on our side, is going to join us for a great conversation. I'm really looking forward to that. And finally, just a brief mention of a wonderful French creation, sort of a digital version of the opera Stravinsky's The Nightingale. Okay, our theme tonight, not connected to money and markets, is I'm proud to be an American. I have just been knocked out over the last week listening to stories on our own team and on, we've got a wonderful group on our prayer call and various subscribers, members of our networks of all kinds. What I'm seeing all throughout the last week is just incredible stories of people helping their families and friends and communities navigate through all the challenges we're dealing with. And the stories of quiet heroism are just, you know, they just take my breath away. You don't read anything about it in the paper or the media, so it's just what's going on in everybody's day-to-day life. But the ability of the American people to maintain a state of decency and generosity in the face of an overwhelming failure of the leadership and the trials that come with both an aging population and the recession is just not to be underestimated. So if you want to, you know, if you really want to cheer yourself up, take the time over the next week to just appreciate the quiet heroism around you and probably, if I know you, that you're doing too, and it really will do your heart good. So that's my theme for this week. I'm proud to be an American. Money and markets, I want to focus on three stories. The first is covert warfare is intensifying. We're watching sort of little things break out all over, you know, violent symptoms of it popping through everywhere with the media struggling to come up with a logical explanation, which they really can't. So it kind of seems more and more Orwellian and strange. The second is a struggle to reassert legitimacy by insecure governments. There's nothing, you know, to be avoided more than an insecure government. And finally, number three, building of groovy new highly controlled channels with social networks. I'll touch on briefly, and one of the stories I'm not going to talk about is Earth Day. It is Earth Day today, and I did a wonderful interview on Alex Jones yesterday, which we'll post tomorrow on the blog, and we talked a lot about the old investment model and the new investment model, and it reminds me that one of the things I want to talk with you about this year, and just and Earth Day helps inspire it, is the importance of understanding what the current financial model is doing to the environment, nothing good, and how a proper investment model and financial system would build up and help the environment heal and be strong. So for a later date, but an important conversation. Okay, one, covert warfare. Let's look at three covert wars that are popping out this week. For all we know, they may be connected, they may not, although these days everything's so centralized. You know, they're probably connected one way or the other. First, we watched a volcano erupt, an active volcano erupt severely in Iceland. It happened Tuesday evening or early Wednesday morning. By Friday, Iceland had done a deal with an IMF. The turnaround there is astonishing. We also saw the dollar up strongly as it happened, and a huge hit to the European economy. The ash resulted in all sorts of air travel. And air travel in Europe is, you know, their commerce is very dependent. Surprising amount of food and other things moves around on air travel. So it's a major economic hit. The patterns look, and I know I've talked with you about my concerns that the tsunami in 2004 was induced and why, but the financial patterns on this one, again, really give you a sense that this could easily have been induced. I put the blog up on the quote up on the blog again to help you understand my thinking on this from Secretary of State of Defense William Cohen's briefing at the Department of Defense in April 28th, 1997. And in fact, I linked to the defense briefing in the blog. But he says, quote, he's talking about different kinds of terrorism, and he says, others are engaging in an echo type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. So this stuff is serious, and my concern is that Iceland is part of a covert war, and the signing of the deal with the IMF does not look good, and the hit to Europe does not look good. Okay, first is the volcano in Iceland and what's going on with Iceland, the IMF, and the various workouts in Europe. Second is Goldman Sachs, oddly enough, someone who has served as a financial advisor and played a major role in the financing of Europe. On Friday, we saw the SEC file a complaint against Goldman. I put up a copy of the complaint on the blog, and I'm at the main blog post on the SEC versus Goldman. I'm posting all the critical and sort of stories I would recommend to follow it. It's not clear to me, after much research and asking my attorney to research as well, it's not clear how good the SEC's case is as a matter of law, although the issue is if they get before a jury, I'm not sure the legal case will matter. Now, in addition, it's not clear to me that they'll ever get in front of a jury. Goldman is being swarmed. This morning, we get announcements that German state bank has cut ties to Goldman Sachs, and the UK regulators announced that they're investigating. In what I call a swarm, what you'll see is somebody behind the scenes working very hard to create real problems for Goldman, both relationships with critical clients and investigations by other governments. There's no doubt that the SEC's filing a lawsuit against Goldman Sachs indicates a vulnerability, a willingness of the United States government to tolerate regulatory action from Goldman. And Goldman's vulnerable both with foreign countries, so Germany and France and the UK are three who've been harmed, but you also have municipalities in other countries, and then you have in this country, you have state attorney generals, and then you have local attorney generals and municipalities as well. So there are plenty of people who can pile in and sue on top of this. And when I say swarm is what happens when you get multiple investigations going, multiple lawsuits going, and ultimately it makes it impossible for Goldman to function in the market. It raises their cost of capital. It raises their expenses. It lowers their income. And literally, being swarmed by a swarm of bees, they get swarmed. There was an old expression on Wall Street when I was there. It was bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered. It would be a disservice to our noble friend the hog to necessarily associate them with Goldman, but I think we may be looking at that kind of situation. I would give them about a 30% chance of making it into this time next year as an independent company. I think somebody's going to pick them up cheap before the year is out. One of their greatest strategic errors in the situation was their failure to report their Wells notification. When the SEC informed them that they were being investigated, they didn't note that in their SEC filings. An interesting thing to watch is going to be the role of Sullivan & Cromwell, traditionally the most powerful law firm in America and on Wall Street, who has been a very, very important part and Goldman's lead counsel, for decades. And you can never underestimate the power of Sullivan & Cromwell, who, of course, will be representing Goldman Sachs. So it's going to be very interesting to see how hard they fight on behalf of the firm. If you look at the stock price, it was down about $13 when the suit was announced on Friday. It traded up, and now it's down again on the announcements of the German State Bank and the UK regulators. But if you look at the stock price, the market clearly is betting them to win. So my view is very, very different than the market. And the shareholder view, I think the market and the financial markets in general and Goldman underestimate the extent to which a variety of governments need to reaffirm their legitimacy. And Goldman, to my surprise, because normally they've been a very savvy firm in the past, but Goldman has made themselves out to be a perfect scapegoat. The military side of the house in the central banking warfare model gets about $1 trillion a year from the U.S. financial mechanism. I posted a great chart up on the blog earlier this week about the total amount of money getting pulled out of the U.S. budgets for the military, $1 trillion a year, including all the money coming from the other agencies, and that does not include the black budget. So what the military can't afford, because their business is a very serious business, for a bunch of traders who are kind of yahooing around Wall Street, really upsetting a lot of people and making the system look not legitimate. They need bankers who can operate quietly and think strategically in this environment. In addition, the administration needs a scapegoat. The bureaucracy needs a scapegoat. And the Democrats really need a scapegoat. And the interesting thing is we now have people, a lot of people from Bear Stearns and Lehman and AIG, all of whom are sort of part of the traditional it's called Our Crowd, was a group of firms in a particular kind of network on Wall Street. So we have people, in essence, in Goldman's old crowd network who are pretty angry at Goldman and will do the dirty work. And what that means is in a world where you have excess capacity in the financial houses, you know, there's a game of musical chairs going on, and so I bet Goldman to lose. And the only question I have, there's another mystery in this. Well, there are many mysteries, but there's a mystery in this thing, and that was the volcano happens Tuesday night. Goldman stock is up, straight up $5 on the Wednesday morning opening, and it almost made you wonder what kind of position Goldman had taken on Iceland bonds. So there's a mystery there, and I bet if we could know the answer to that, it might tell us something about the struggle that's going on. So watch this unfold, because it's going to be quite a drama. Goldman and its counsel, Sullivan and Cromwell, are very, very powerful. But they've really put themselves in a corner over this one, so this is going to be quite a fight. The third one is what I call oil explosion contagion. We have watched a series of oil and gas explosions at refineries and drilling sites, and it's hard to imagine that these are just natural accidents. I posted a little blog post up with a list of some of them, and so there's a story there. I can't tell you what it is, but there's a story, and it's worth watching. And all of these things are a sign that what I described in my year-end wrap-up of the grinding of the gears is going on, and it's getting more and more violent. Expect these covert squabbles to grow throughout the summer. This is going to be a long, hot, tense summer. And so this is a summer where it's good to kind of stay away from the tapeworm and lay low. The struggle to reassert legitimacy, second item, by insecure governments. We've seen some astonishing polls. Just take your breath away. Rasmussen, again, who I love, comes up with a poll that basically shows if we had an election today between Ron Paul and Obama, it would be a dead heat. That is breathtaking. Other polls that say that the Tea Parties represent the thinking of Americans on all sides of the political spectrum more than the Democrats or the Republicans. And finally, we have an MSNBC poll saying 78% of Americans don't trust big government. Now, these are very, very strong polls. You've heard me say many times it takes 80% to get a major shift. Well, 78% saying they don't trust big government coming into a major congressional election, major because this is a year when there are a lot of policies in flux. That's a very that's a number that can get a lot of people in Washington feeling very, very insecure. And to add salt to the wounds, on April 15th, while everybody, including me, is filing our taxes, what do we get but reports from large corporations and banks announcing essentially they're paying little to no taxes? So it's really a funny situation. The Democrats, on top of it, we saw last week Clinton in testimony hanging Rubens and Summers out to dry, saying, you know, they gave me bad advice on derivatives, I took it, and basically pointing, you look at the articles, they're kind of pointing to the Goldman Sachs guys, and we put it up on the blog saying the rats are jumping ship. And, you know, in both instances, whether it was the Clinton administration or the Obama administration. The Obama administration has a couple of Goldman problems, the big one being the Goldman AIG deal. And if the SEC or anyone went after Goldman on that deal, or any of the enforcers went after Goldman on that deal, that would blow right back into the White House and the administration. So attacking them on something that doesn't move back into the Clinton administration, doesn't move back into this administration, instead happened on the Bush administration's watch, is sort of politically smart, keeps things away from AIG, keeps things away from the White House, keeps all sorts of questions away, but it focuses on one of the areas of the corruption that's of interest to Main Street, which is the mortgage market. The president announced today he's going to keep the $1 million of donations he got from Goldman Sachs employees. That was the smart decision. It's his way of affirming I didn't do anything wrong, particularly given that they've brought this action. It's the smart political decision, but a very cool, savvy decision. We're watching now, seven state attorney generals are investigating Monsanto. That's also up on the blog. A number of different pieces, modified hangouts in both in the TV and corporate print media on vaccines. Clearly, there's some kind of effort, I believe, after the huge failure on swine flu vaccine to come back out and try and reaffirm vaccines. What you feel in all of this is a very funny positioning going on in the brands, because the sort of the American grassroots response has been to be pro-constitution, pro-laws as they apply to fiduciary and government money and financial management, and very much taking responsibility and working the nuts and bolts system. So we've almost had the mandate of heaven, my favorite term from the Chinese, pass from the U.S. government to the people, and the government's being lawless and Wall Street's being lawless, and the people are being very lawful. And government really has a legitimacy problem, and we've seen in the last week a real effort to attack the Tea Party as if they're very, you know, allegations of sexism and racism and all sorts of divide and conquer issues ultimately, which won't work. But it shows you the sort of the fear and the concern and the paranoia, that government is really losing its feeling of legitimacy. All of this is another reason why it's so important to focus at state and local elections, because we want people who we really trust handling those positions, and that way it's much easier to have a very grounded conversation. It's much harder to sabotage an election where you and the person running have more relationship and better understanding of the issues, and it's just harder to dirty trick it. So it just gets back to the importance of sort of nuts and bolts, grassroots activism. Okay, third, I wanted to talk about the building of controlled groovy new channels with social networks, and just to say a few words, we're seeing a dramatic transformation of consumer marketing and from TV and print to online going into the social networks. It's very, very important to understand that you should assume there is no privacy in these things. And it's hard to talk with some people about because they so love them and they can be so much fun and so useful. But just appreciate that all of the information that you're posting is going into databases that are probably ultimately in the back connected with other databases. And we're going to be talking more about things like that with privacy with Catherine. Very quickly on Ask Catherine, great comment from somebody in Maui says, whoa, after we talked about chemtrails last week, they said, no, we've got them here. I checked with somebody else on the Big Island. They said, no, we don't. So I'm not quite clear about what's going on with chemtrails in Hawaii, but thank you for Maui for that comment. A comment from someone on our mission, they said that they were concerned, given my concerns with GMO food, that I'm anti-technology, a little bit of a Luddite. And I just wanted to make sure y'all understood, my mission is not to be fair or unfair to corporations. It's not my mission. My mission is to make sure that you are healthy and wealthy and wise, and ditto your family, and if you have energy to do so, ditto your community. And so if something is not wonderful for you and has not been proven by by a shadow of a doubt, I'm going to be very concerned with it. So I have no interest in giving balanced reports on genetically modified food until genetically modified food has been absolutely proven beyond a shadow of a doubt to be good for you. I'm going to have a very different take on it. And my time is not going to be spent, to be fair, to genetically modified food. It's going to be spent on trying to figure out how I can help you get the best, freshest, highest quality food on an affordable price. So not to say that I'm not interested in all those issues, but, we're not here to be fair to big corporations. They've got enough resources to try and make it convenient and to defend themselves. Okay, another question. Little known fact, T-bills will convert an emergency to 30-year bonds by government. Is this true? I've never heard anything about that, and I will be researching it. Just to let you know that the government does take the position that they have the right to confiscate any and all assets. So in an emergency with an executive order, who knows what could happen? Why are they killing the goose? Another question, why are they killing the goose that lays the golden egg? I very simply put, they've stolen the eggs, and they have other flocks to fry. They don't need this goose. So we're all spoiled into thinking that the powers that be need the American consumer. The reality is they've rebalanced. They're in the process of rebalancing the economy, and they don't. And we need to take that into consideration when we think about the politics of our situation. So with that, let me turn to our fabulous guest. And let me just introduce her very briefly. I first saw Catherine on Aaron Rousseau's wonderful documentary, From Freedom to Fascism, and I was so excited to see someone who was extremely capable, extremely intelligent, taking on what is an important and a complex topic, and a topic where I have always struggled to help people understand how literally frightening the agenda is of the top people with respect to use of this technology. And Catherine does such an incredible job. She has her own radio show. She's a very popular speaker, and she's the author of a number of books, helps done a whole series of different documentaries. You can find them all on her website. We've linked from her blog. Her latest book is Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Purchase and Watch Your Every Move, and I can't recommend it enough. It just does a wonderful job of helping you understand all the different ways this kind of technology can be very invasive and create risk for you. And again, my goal is to help you have the information you need to protect your family and yourself from those kinds of risks. So with that, Catherine, let me welcome you to the Solari Report.
Well, Catherine, I'm delighted to be on, and hello to all of your wonderful team of folks here listening and becoming informed. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't you just tell us it's a fascinating story, how you became so knowledgeable about RFID technology, and you ended up creating this whole incredible career preventing it.
Yeah, it's kind of a wild story. I actually became a privacy advocate back in 1999 as sort of an armchair activist. I was a graduate student, and originally being from California and going to school at Harvard, I was spending a part of the year in each half of the country, and I found myself with a wallet full of cards, plastic cards, pertaining to each place. In fact, I wound up with so many of these dumb cards that I had my separate California wallet and my separate East Coast wallet, with everything from the card that I needed to access the library to the card that I needed to get my discounts at the supermarket, and the CVS pharmacy card on the East Coast, and the Ralph's grocery store card in the California. So it got to the point where everywhere I went, somebody was asking me, do you have your such-and-so card? And I felt like I was carrying around a deck of playing cards, and I'd go one place, and they'd say, we want the Three of Spades, and I'd go somewhere else, and they'd say, we want the Jack of Hearts, and I was constantly going through this thick stack. I mean, it was close to an inch thick of cards. And one day it dawned on me that there was more than just an annoyance factor to this trend that was beginning in the mid-1990s, that actually the requesting of a card or an account or some kind of a loyalty program with every shopping and everything that I did was actually creating a database about me. every time I handed over the card and it was swiped, an entry was going somewhere. And so I started to become very interested in where those entries were going and how they all connected together and what this trend meant. And the ones that really bothered me the most once I realized that every plastic card represented a database were the supermarket cards. And so I, back in 1999, I founded an organization called Caspian, Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And our original website is still online. It's at nocards.org, N-O-C-A-R-D-S. We fought back against supermarket cards. I did a number of years of research on that topic and actually wound up writing my dissertation at Harvard University, where I have a degree in consumer education and psychology. And I wound up actually writing that on the issue of supermarket cards because, for me, what the cards represented was the most visible piece of an enormous infrastructure of data collection that was happening under the waterline. If you want to picture it sort of as an iceberg, we had this visible piece, which was the plastic cards hanging off of people's keychains, but underneath it was this enormous mountain of data. And not only that, but the use of these cards was creating an infrastructure where we were moving away from what had always been the case, which is, well, not always, but certainly the local cash register concept, which was just a calculator with a cash drawer, and switching to a very different concept, which was high-speed, ubiquitously networked computer terminals hooked up through the Internet or through satellites in real time to one another, to where all of the point-of-purchase transactions that we were engaging in were being centralized and consolidated into these enormous databases. And what I discovered back then, just that alone was enough to send chills down my spine. Here in New England, I live in New Hampshire, our biggest grocery chain here is a chain called Stop and Shop. It's owned by a European company called Royal Ahold, A-H-O-L-D. It's actually pronounced Royal Ahold, but I get in trouble when I say that. And Royal Ahold and its Stop and Shop corporation here created, they hit on this idea about 10 years ago that they wanted to avail themselves of all of the data that they had collected. And by the way, what I did my dissertation on, I discovered that 3/4 of Americans, and probably many people on this phone call, are not aware that when you scan the supposed discount card, that they are making a record, an itemized record of every single item that you purchased. It's going into a database along with the time and date of your purchase, your payment method, your credit card number, your ATM card number. They use that information to deduce whether, you know, how old your children are. Let's figure out when you started buying the baby food and the diapers, whether you have a cat, whether you have a dog, whether you have diabetes, whether you have a health condition, whether you have house guests. They use that for all sorts of extraordinarily invasive bits of information about your home life. And what I discovered that took that sort of to the next level, and this ties in with some of your concerns, Catherine, about the health care bill, is Stop and Shop had actually invested $3 million to create a data mining software program that they could apply to the millions of records that they had collected on shoppers in their stores over, at that time, 8 years of time. It's now up to probably 15 or more. And what this program would do is it would take an individual shopping record and convert it into a health profile. So you could actually say, let me type in the name of a particular individual, and I'd like to know everything that this person has purchased, but I don't really care if you buy, you know, Heinz ketchup and Tropicana orange juice. What I really care is talk to me about total number of calories, talk to me about the size of the household, the amount of green leafy vegetables, the amount of saturated fat, the amount of sugar. And they have actually entered into all of these databases the exact nutritional content of every single object on the store shelf. So this one program was able to not only tell how much of X substance you had been consuming, but it also had a very disturbing pull-down menu where you could say, well, this person has diabetes. How does their eating habits look? This person has high blood pressure. What about their intake of sodium? Hey, this person over here has clogged arteries or a heart condition. Let's talk about their consumption of saturated fats and cholesterol. And it would actually give a rating. on the basis of the things that household had purchased.
Now, and there's absolutely no disclosure to the consumer that they're doing this.
No, none. And when I first became aware of this, it's actually kind of a long story, but I was at a meeting at MIT where they were talking about this pretty openly. It was actually Kurt Allen.
I love your story and spy chips of you sitting in this meeting and hearing all. It's great.
I've been in so many juicy meetings, Catherine. But this was a different one. I don't think this one made it into spy chips. This particular meeting, Kurt Avalon, who's the VP for New Technology for Stop and Shop, was presenting to a group of graduate students, of whom I was one, and he was trying, what these big companies do is they fund these technology, these graduate programs in technology, and they'll help fund they'll fund a wing of the program or send a certain amount of funding, and in exchange for that they get to come and pitch their projects to the graduate students in hopes that some graduate student will say, well, that's interesting, I'll write my dissertation and do all my graduate research on this, and then they essentially get an MIT brain for free. So that's kind of how this works. So he was pitching this and trying to get MIT students on board to become a part of this program to mine this rich vein of data. And it was so many interesting things came out of that talk because, you know, people were asking, well, why don't you make this publicly available? And he said, well, we briefly tried that as a way to get people to come into the store and keep track of their own nutritional profile. He said, but people's response was so negative. He said, it comes as no surprise to you in this room, but the average person finds it actually quite scary that we know this amount of information about them. So they fully know, and they try to keep it quiet and under wraps. And what really disturbed me is I raised my hand and I said, you know, $3 million, that's a lot of money. You clearly have a real interest in your consumers and your shoppers, your customers. What do you plan to do with that? And this is where the chills went down my spine. He said, well, we would like to recoup some of that investment, and we'd like to share this information with HMOs.
Good
and I went,
Lord.
Oh, my gosh, if your HMO can get a hold of this level of detail about your health, and it truly is the case that you are what you eat. So
right.
If you're eating garbage, you're probably not going to be very well. And he wanted to turn this over to the HMOs who could use it to deny you your coverage or cancel your policy or raise your rates and not even have to tell you why. So that's the kind of thing that I spent the first couple of years as an activist pursuing and sounding the alarm about. And then in 2002 or 2003, I was approached by the Denver University Law Review to write an article on shopper cards. And they had said 14 pages, but I somehow understood 40. So I spent like 6 months of my life writing this extraordinarily detailed article on shopper cards. And if anyone on this call would like to get a copy, you can just email me, kma@spychips.com, and I'll send you a PDF of this document, this 40-page article that tells you everything you could ever possibly want to know about the downsides of supermarket frequent shopper cards. And it's called Loyalty Cards Tip of the Retail Surveillance Iceberg. So that's the name of it. And again, it's kma@spychips.com. And while I was researching this, I ran across a quote by a man named John Sturmer. He's a VP for AC Nielsen, the market research folks. And what he said in this quote, and I'll paraphrase, but he essentially said, first there was the barcode, which did a really good job telling us what was being sold. Then along came the frequent shopper card, which told us who was buying those items. But there's still all of these blind spots in our knowledge. We still don't know when, where, and how people use the things after they've bought them. He said, but there's a new technology on the horizon, RFID, which promises to fill in those gaps in our knowledge. And I read that and I went, called what, huh? What are you talking about? How we use our products? That's in our homes. That's in my bathroom and my kitchen. You've got to be kidding me. And that led me on what has now become, I guess, like a 7-8 year quest to learn everything I could about this proposal to put tiny microchips hooked up to miniature antennas onto every physical object on the globe. And when I say every object, their quote is everything from sewing needles to jumbo jets. They want to link all of these items up. So every object, instead of having a barcode or in addition to a barcode, would have an embedded microchip antenna combo called a transponder for transmit and respond that would pick up and respond to ambient electromagnetic radiation, what we would call radio waves. And these little devices would be capable of transmitting whenever they came within range of one another or when they came within range of a reader device. And they would create an entire network in which every object at all times would be ubiquitously tracked and located.
And so as I kept reading Spy Chips, I kept wondering, how does this fit in with Wi-Fi and cell towers?
Yeah, there are companies that are working on that, actually trying to find ways to make it fit in. But it's a little bit different because when we think about GPS tracking or cell phone, cell towers, we're talking about technologies, especially GPS. Let me contrast RFID with GPS because that's a very good question. When you're talking about an RFID tag, you're talking about a relatively short read range. RFID tags, it's a microchip and an antenna. They don't have their own power source, usually. They're working on ways to create cheap power sources for them, but they're years away from developing that. So right now, they're passive, meaning they have no power. Some people say, oh, well, then that's fine. But I always respond to that by saying, no, that's really a problem because they never wear out.
Right, exactly.
They live forever if they don't have a battery. At least with a battery, you hope the thing dies at some point. So the vision here is that these microchips would be embedded into things. And I'll give you an example of some of the stuff we've seen. They can be pressed between the layers of the soles of a pair of shoes. They can be sewn into the seams of clothing. They can be placed into buttons so that things can undergo high-temperature washer, dryer processing without any problems. They can be pressed into paper. They can be placed between the pages of a book or into the cardboard of a package. So there's lots and lots of ways to incorporate these into items. They can be dropped into the plastic mold when an object is made in a factory. And once they've got, once the object has been embedded with its RFID tag, the RFID tag lies dormant. It does not emit any energy or do anything. But the moment you come within range of a radiation field, an EMF field, the field is picked up by the antenna and used to sort of bring these things to life. So the best way to understand it is if you've got a doorway, and the doorway is equipped with an RFID reader embedded in the actual frame of the door, as you walk through the doorway, you're walking into sort of an energy cloud. And that energy cloud wakes up all of your chips, causes them all to instantly release their data out into that cloud, where they're then picked up, and then they're individually processed. And the and as soon as you pass through the doorway and you're a couple feet away, boom, the cloud no longer is reaching you or powering up your tags, and they all go back to sleep again. So the vision here is that these clouds of reader power would be embedded in the environment everywhere we go. And in Spy Chips, we revealed for the first time a patent by IBM for something they call the Person Tracking Unit, which I thought was such a compelling name. The Person Tracking Unit is an RFID reader that would emit this energy to read these tags. And what was really disturbing about this is that that IBM was talking about where they want to put these, and they said essentially they want to put them everywhere. Museums, theaters, libraries, sports arenas, shopping malls, even elevators and public restrooms. So that literally everywhere you go, the environment would be scanning you. They'd be performing a kind of frisk of everything you were wearing and carrying and getting back all this information. So the consumer tracking model from this stuff that IBM envisioned, that American Express envisioned, that a lot of these companies envision that we talk about in the book, is every individual item would have something called an EPC, which is, right now we've got the UPC barcode, the Universal Product Code. This is the EPC, Electronic Product Code. It is a 96-bit string of numbers or string of information. 96 bits is 96 zeros and ones. And for the mathematicians in the crowd, that's 2 to the 96th power. That is enough unique number combinations to number every grain of sand on Earth with no duplicates. So they will never run out of numbers. At least it'll take them a long time.
Right.
And the idea is that, like today, if you're holding a can of Coke and I'm holding a can of Coke and we compare the barcodes, they're going to be the same. In this future world, every can of Coke, even in a six-pack, would have a different number from every other can of Coke. So that individual items, and now this ties back with the shopper cards, when you purchase the item gets scanned. Each individual EPC number gets recorded in a database and linked with your identity as derived from a credit card or a shopper card. And then those individual items now are, quote-unquote, registered to you. So in the future, And they call this, by the way, the Internet of Things, where each
And I would like to point out that IBM, I've been talking a lot on the Slayer Report about the census, and we've written a couple of special reports up on the blog. IBM is a lead contractor on the census.
Oh, IBM is in this stuff so deep, it's horrifying. If you go to ibm.com/smarterplanet, you can actually read that IBM has plans to essentially monitor and control every aspect of human life on the globe. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Right.
So, yeah, IBM is very, very deeply involved in this. And IBM is referred to, you know, shoppers in Germany as guinea pigs for their new technology and spied on them secretly, and it's disgusting. So this vision that these person tracking units would be embedded everywhere and that each individual object, so let's just talk about, you know, a pair of Nike size 8 Nike running shoes that I might buy at, you know, Foot Locker and pay for with a credit card, which I personally wouldn't do because I don't use credit cards, but a lot of people do. Then as I pay for that pair of shoes, they scan it. They get unique ID number 308247, et cetera. That object has its own data entry, and they call this the Internet of Things. So instead of having a URL, it's got that little number, and it's got its whole history. You know, the shoe was made in Malaysia and then, you know, shipped onto a boat from China and arrived in a warehouse in Montreal, whatever. And the latest entry says, and it was purchased by Catherine Albrecht at a Foot Locker in Nashua, New Hampshire. Now, in the future, when I walk through a doorway, the courthouse, the 7-Eleven, wherever it is, when I walk through that doorway and I pass by a scanner, the scanner picks up 308247 off my shoe and adds a new entry into the database for that object that says, hey, seen at the 7-Eleven in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Hey, you know, seen walking into the Boston courthouse. And so each of these entries gets logged in and linked both to that object and to me. So that's kind of the vision for the ubiquitous tracking network based on stuff. We saw that coming back in 2002, 2003, 2004. We did all sorts of high-profile protests. I flew to Germany, and we headed up a protest there. We did protests in England. We protested Walmart's here. We launched a boycott against Gillette, which was using this in a surreptitious way to take pictures of people in stores. We boycotted Benetton, the big Italian clothing manufacturer. So there were a lot of very high-profile battles that occurred, and the industry quickly realized that they were going to have a real fight on their hands if they wanted to move forward with the tagging of consumer products. So what they instead did is they took a totally different approach in 2005, and they said, all right, well, we can't win with these consumer groups, so what we're going to do instead is we're going to start lobbying the government, because they can boycott Walmart, but they can't boycott the State Department. And they were able, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, to get multinational government organizations to agree to incorporate RFID into identity documents, into passports. So U.S. passports have had RFID tags on board for the last couple of years. It is now mandatory that all new U.S. passports be embedded with an RFID tag. We are now seeing RFID tags introduced into things called enhanced driver's licenses, which are optional border crossing combo driver's licenses being issued in the states of Washington, Arizona, Michigan, New York, and Vermont currently. And these, you have to pay a little extra. You're not going to get one by mistake, but they're driver's licenses that have an RFID tag antenna combination in them that can be read from 60 feet away, and you actually have to pay for the privilege of carrying one of these hideous tracking devices. When you have RFID, what people should understand, because it uses radio waves, It transmits through the things we normally rely on to protect our privacy. Those would be things like purses and pockets and wallets and backpacks. Those would be things like walls. So
now, I wanted to ask you, because I've been using these special packets.
Yes.
You know, so my passport and some of the cards go in special packets.
Good.
And my hope is that then they can't be read.
Or you can just wrap them in tinfoil. Yeah. The tinfoil hat crowd was actually onto something. It
right.
Actually does block RFID transmissions to have something wrapped in tinfoil. In fact, there's only two things that really block an RFID transmission. One of them is aluminum foil or lead, for that matter. And the other one is actually liquid. And that gets to kind of a side issue on RFID, which is its safety. That tinfoil blocks or aluminum foil blocks an RFID transmission is, let's say I'm carrying something with an RFID tag on it and I come within range of the reader. the energy from the reader has to hit the tag and reflect back cleanly. If I have tinfoil around it, instead of hitting the object, it's going to bounce back and bounce erratically all over the place, and I won't get a clean read. In the case of water, it's the opposite. When water, let's say you take an RFID tag, and they really struggled to figure out how to tag things like Tide laundry detergent, for example, because it's all water. If you put a tag on that, the beam of energy hits it and absorbs into the water, because water absorbs electromagnetic radiation. Now, that's a problem because we are water. So
right.
When we walk through these doorways, we are essentially sponges sucking up this energy, and that makes it very difficult for the reader to get a clean read reflecting back. And that's important, and this leads me to the third place that RFID is appearing. So we got consumer products, we got government ID documents, and the third place is implants. So the reason that an RFID tag on a driver's license has a 60-foot read range and an RFID tag on a microchip implant in a dog or a human has like a 6-inch read range has to do with two factors, actually multiple factors, but the ones that are relevant to us are the fact that you're made out of water, so you're going to absorb that energy instead of reflecting it back, and the microchip antenna is much smaller on an implant. If I could describe them, they're about, if you picture, hold your thumb and your forefinger apart as though you were holding a dime on edge. That is the length of an RFID microchip implant, a Verichip implant. So, you know, people think they're the size of specks of dust. They're not. They're actually pretty long. They're a little bit narrower around than a Tic Tac. So that's the size of them. The way they're comprised inside, they've got a tiny microchip, they've got an antenna wrapped around them, and the whole shebang is encased in a capsule of medical-grade glass that's sealed. And then they dip about two-thirds of the glass into a polypropylene plastic substance called BioBond. So if you could picture, kind of take a little capsule of glass and dip it into wax, melted wax, and that's kind of what they look like. That BioBond is actually, if you look at it under a microscope, it's porous and scratchy. And the reason they do that is because when you put an implant into an animal or a person, that little capsule of glass just slips around inside the body and it migrates. And a lot of times dogs, they'll be microchipped at the scruff of the neck. They'll later find the microchip halfway down the dog's leg because they scoot around. So they added this this little plastic substance called BioBond because when a foreign body goes into an animal or a person, the body encapsulates it. It wants to create a tissue to sort of wall it off because it's a foreign, you know, it's a foreign substance. It doesn't belong in there. So your body tries to wall it off by creating this little capsule. And when they've got the BioBond sort of links up and the tissues sort of intertwine into that BioBond. Now that's important because these implantable versions of RFID have actually been found to cause cancer in laboratory animals. And when they look microscopically at why it is that between 1 and 10% of laboratory rodents implanted with these devices for identification purposes develop cancer around the implants, what they found is that the cancer actually originates at the site of that plastic anchoring barb. And so as the body creates this little capsule to try to, well, first your body tries to push it out. I mean, if you got a splinter, we've all had this experience, your body eventually pushes the splinter to the surface and it kind of comes out. That's one of the problems with implantable microchips. Some people have actually had them gush back out of their bodies. It's hard to keep them in the animals sometimes unless they plant them very deep. If the body can't push it out, it will actually try to encapsulate it and wall it off in the way that we described. And that encapsulation process sometimes goes horribly wrong and leads to a fast-growing malignant tumor that can kill these animals within a matter of months. We do know that that same tumor initiation process around foreign bodies is operative in human beings, probably not to the same extent that it is in laboratory animals, but it is a problem. People with pacemakers and vagus nerve stimulators and other implants have developed sarcomas and other cancers around them. So we do know that foreign bodies in human beings are probably not the greatest idea.
Have any private companies gotten away with requiring implants?
Yeah, the thing about the implants, when the FDA approved the implant back in 2004, there was no discussion at all of these cancer findings. In fact, nobody knew about them. The FDA was not told. Verichip knew, but they didn't tell the FDA. We've pieced that together. And the FDA approves devices without, by just allowing the company to provide its own evidence. They don't do their own independent investigation. So they gave the Verichip the stamp of approval under the watch of Tommy Thompson, who is the former Secretary of Health and Human Services under the Bush administration. And that's significant because Tommy Thompson, who was arguably the most powerful public health official on the planet when that device was approved, later, within a period of months, resigned his position as Director of Health and Human Services and took a position on the board of directors for the Verichip implant company. And in that role, he did a number of television interviews in which he said that he looked forward to the day that all Americans would have a microchip implant to manage their electronic medical records. So we do know that Tommy Thompson, at the very least, was very publicly promoting this as a medical records application. At about that same time, a Cincinnati surveillance company called City Watcher, which is actually a pretty small company, had two employees microchipped to access a secure records room where they stored videotape footage. And in Mexico, 18 members of the staff of the Attorney General, along with the Attorney General of Mexico, who, by the way, later resigned in a political scandal. But anyway, he and 18 members of his staff were also microchip implanted for access to a secure records room as well. We don't know.
But didn't we just have Virginia pass a law saying no company in Virginia could require implants?
Virginia, Wisconsin, California, North Dakota, Georgia,
fabulous.
A whole bunch of states passing these laws.
This may turn into one of the ultimate 10th Amendment issues.
Well, and let me address those really quickly because we have got a website where we actually broke the story on the cancer connection with the microchip. And just to get back and finish that thought, back in 2007, these microchips were looking very frightening. You had Tommy Thompson saying he wanted all of us to get one for our medical records. You had Blue Cross Blue Shield conducting trials with this. You had the Alzheimer's Community Care Center down in Florida implanting 200 Alzheimer's patients and another 200 caregivers. You had, I mean, this stuff was really moving.
Right.
And at that time, I was actually contacted by the owner of a bulldog, Leon, who developed cancer around his microchip. And his owner, Jeannie, had devoted a couple years of her life to have it written up in the medical literature. And she said, he's not the only case. Check it out. So I checked it out. My jaw hit the floor. I said, there's a whole ton of literature on this topic. There's lots of evidence that these things cause cancer. How come we're not hearing about it? So I worked for 6 months with Todd Lewin with the Associated Press to get the story out. And I spent hours in the basement of the medical library at Harvard gathering these articles, which weren't even scanned or online. I mean, these were like print articles in obscure veterinary pathology journals and toxicology journals. So we got the story out, and when that story broke, here's the good news to cheer up everybody on the call here. The Verichip stock at that time, with all this breathless excitement, they were on the Today Show, too, and you had, what's her name, the blonde CFR member, Diane Sawyer. You had Diane Sawyer, you know, applauding this. You had the Jacobs family getting chipped on TV. And their stock was trading at about $11 a share. After the cancer story broke, they canceled all the Blue Cross Blue Shield trials. No more employees got implanted anywhere at any companies. And we watched their stock value go from $11 a share to 30 cents a share.
Bravo.
Yeah, so that was exciting.
We call
exciting.
That stock whacking, pop whacking.
It was fun. It was very, very fun. So since that time, we've been hearing less, let me say that, about anybody being microchipped in any way other than totally voluntarily. And even then, I think, you know, there's definitely a stigma attached to these microchips because of the cancer. I should also point out that next month, actually in the first week in June, I'm going to be presenting my paper at an IEEE conference, which is fabulous because it's been peer-reviewed now and it's now officially part of the academic literature on the topic. And that document, if people would like to see it, is online at antichips.com. It's microchips and tumors, and just click on cancer. You can find it there. And the other thing, we are working right now on a website to bring awareness to the dogs that have developed cancer around these chips in an effort to stop mandatory dog microchipping. In the UK, they're about to have an election over there. We're working with a sister group in the UK to try to prevent them from passing a law that would require the mandatory microchipping of every dog in the United Kingdom. So we're talking about millions of animals overnight would be required to be microchipped. And the concern, of course, first of all, these things cause cancer. We just reported 2 or 3 weeks ago about 2 more dogs that have developed cancer, horrible tumors around these microchips. One dog had a 4.5-pound tumor around 2 microchips, accidentally had been implanted twice. So we're getting the word out about this. We've got a new website that's going to be going up in a couple of weeks at chipmenot.com.
Chipmenot?
Chipmenot.com. We, by the way, are looking for funding assistance with that. It's going to cost us a little over $1,000 to get all that put together. So if anybody on the call would like to help us out, we'd appreciate the help. So that's going up to essentially be a forum where people can report the adverse reactions. And we have a feeling that there are literally thousands of dogs developing cancer right now. Lots of anecdotal reports, and we're going to be following up with the pathologists and the veterinarians and the x-rays. And
what? So in the new health care bill was this section called National Medical Device Registry. What is that about?
Let me talk about that, because there was a lot of rumors swimming around about that. They are essentially wrong. the rumors said, hey, this new health care bill says we're all going to be chipped. And the reality is the new healthcare bill actually simply says that Class 2 medical device implants will have a new registry created for them. Now, that's everything from breast implants to plastic surgery, you know, cheek implants to, yes, it would include also implantable microchips, but that's a very small portion of this large class of Class 2 implantable medical devices. And so, frankly, I don't get what all the fuss is about, because what they're really just saying, hey, people are being implanted with stuff. A lot of this stuff, we don't know if it's safe or not. So
I'll tell you what the fuss is about, and I'll say this as a former regulator. The way you – if you want to promote the implants, the way you do it is you build it, you get funding to build the infrastructure and get it ready, and you do it as part of something which is much bigger. So
yeah,
when I look at this as a regulator, I say, uh-oh. So I think there really is a reason to be concerned.
Having studied this for the last, I don't know, 8 years of my life, that's not what I see when I look at that.
Okay.
I see other nasty things coming down the pike, absolutely. And believe
oh,
me,
yeah,
very
it's the whole, the, any funding to build an infrastructure for a central healthcare database about anything is, to me, is a very big uh-oh.
Yeah, but you have to understand how the FDA regulation already works. You know, it already operates in that Class 3 medical devices have to be registered.
Right.
So the fact that they're expanding that to Class 2 medical devices, you know, I'm not seeing that as targeting specifically the Verichip, because if you look at the number of Class 2 implantable devices out there, the Verichip is like nothing. It's nothing. I mean, there's only 300 people chipped in this whole country.
Right.
So I when they want to do it, Catherine, I think they'll just go forward and do it. I don't think they're going to try some backdoor weird thing about, you know, throwing in a thing about implantable Class 2 medical devices. When they want to do it, they're going to do it openly. So, anyway.
So take us up to the national ID and the risks of chipping.
Well, there are really 3 areas, and I can refer people, because I realize we have limited time. I want to refer people to 3 different areas of chipping and 3 different resources to learn about them. One of them is the chipping of consumer products, which is going forward quietly behind the scenes. And to understand that, you need to read our book, Spy Chips, and go to our website at spychips.com. One of them is the chipping of humans and animals. And to understand that, you need to read the FAQ document, 80 questions for free, online at antichips.com and the information we have there. The third is the area of government documents being tagged with RFID and payment devices being tagged with RFID. To understand that, you need to obtain a copy of the article that I wrote last fall for Scientific American on this topic. And that's currently not online. You actually have to pay for it. I'm going to see if they'll give me permission to put it on my website. But Scientific American, if you have access to it, look up my name, Catherine Albrecht, and RFID, And I wrote a lengthy and extensive article on the use of RFID in identity documents. Now, what people, just to bring you up to speed, when we launched these shots across the bow of the RFID industry on the consumer tagging and were successful, things shifted very dramatically within the RFID industry itself, and they shifted probably in a horrible direction. The biggest RFID market on the globe in 2008 was not Procter & Gamble or Walmart, as had been predicted by everybody. It was actually the government of China. And the reason the government of China was the biggest single order for RFID on the globe that year was because they purchased an RFID microchip for the national ID document of every single person in China.
Right.
So 1 billion of these things have now gone into Chinese ID documents. That means that every Chinese citizen walking down the street can be tagged, identified, logged, et cetera, from 60 feet away. And if you look at what's going on in the city of Shenzhen, which is a big high-rise, a big modern metropolis there, it is the model city on the globe right now for citizen tracking.
Right. It's basically being prototyped in China.
Yeah. Shenzhen has pretty much been equipped now. They've got listening devices in the cabs. They've got cameras everywhere linked up with RFID, facial recognition. It's all blanketing the entire city of Shenzhen, and it's all being used in conjunction with these RFID microchips that enable you to know who it is you're seeing on the video camera. And if you aim a reader device at a Chinese citizen, what you get back, if you are a communist military person or whoever's doing this, you get back not only their medical history, their educational history, their employment history, you get their reproductive history, you get everything back in a single database on these individuals. So somebody could literally be walking down the street, on the other side of the street, you point a little reader at them, boom, and you get back all this information. So that is, I think, the direction that globally we are all headed. There's something called the Porvoo Group, P-O-O-R-V-O-O, which stemmed out of an international meeting in Iceland a couple of years ago that has really grown legs. That is the plan for all national ID cards worldwide to be consolidated into a single standard. And the one place that they've had such difficulty is the United States, because we are one of the only remaining countries on the globe that does not have a national ID card and has adamantly and vehemently resisted all efforts to impose one. And until they can lock us down and get us on board with the national ID card, they're going to have a hard time with this big global system. We're going to be the one holdout. You know, the Graham Schumer bill, this is the immigration bill, the bipartisan immigration bill, I should say, that would require all of us to have a biometric ID card to have a job. That is one of the ways that they are hoping. See, they keep coming back and trying
they
to
keep looking
over.
For a political air cover.
They're looking for the wedge that will get us to accept national ID. And because
right.
the opponents to national ID have all been freedom-loving, patriot-type folks, and usually operating from the right, they're hoping that if they can get that constituency hyped up enough about illegal immigration, which is a real hot button that they can push to make that particular contingency of our nation sort of jump to their tune, that if they can poke people enough with this immigration issue, that they can get people to support the national ID card on that front. They've tried it before. It failed 2 or 3 years ago when they gave us the big immigration hoo-ha on the front page of Time magazine. They did that, by the way. If people want to understand why that issue came, flared up huge and then died away, and why now nobody seems to care about it in the media, they did that to coincide with the Real ID program, because
right.
they wanted us at that point to embrace the Real ID national ID program. The immigration thing didn't work as a strategy, and so they dropped it like a hot potato. And that's why you never saw any of those grandiose plans for actually doing anything about illegal immigration.
Now, I'm going to run over a little bit today just because I really want to get this in. We have 3 questions from subscribers I'd love to ask you, including one about one of my favorite topics, Google and the search engine. So
yes.
Let me just run through these quickly. First one, Chase Bank's old credit card had a quarter-inch chip with antenna wires for Blink in it. Why is their new credit card made with a black middle piece added in the middle of the entire body of the card?
I haven't actually seen that. Chase Blink, along with the American Express Blue Card, were the 2 of the very first RFID-based credit cards ever introduced. Now they're called PayPass, and I'm betting that people on this call right now have them in their wallets. These things can be scanned right through your wallet. A pickpocket would just have to brush near you in order to pick up the information on it. And researchers at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst a couple years back were able to show that when you scan these things, you get the full name, the full credit card number, and the expiration date right off of them.
Wow.
So, you know, they're clearly a target for identity theft. But my bigger concern is that these tagged payment devices are leading to the dissemination of tagged payment stations. So you can go into a McDonald's, a grocery store, soon a movie theater, and you can find these little PayPass Wave and Go devices right there at the cash register. My concern is that that technology is identical, with just a few minor tweaks, to the Verichip implant. And if you had a Verichip implant in your hand, all you'd have to do is just wave your hand over that device. So
right, because we're the national. If you get a global national ID going, then you're looking at a world currency.
Yes, and they're doing this in China. Again, China has something called the Octopus Card that was first introduced in Hong Kong. They now want to spread it to the mainland and use it as not only a transit device, which is what it is now. You got to scan it to get on the train or the subway so they can track where you go. But now you can use it to pay for things at you know, convenience stores. And they're now in talks with the government to consolidate this Octopus payment transit card with the national ID card that we were just talking about. So you'd have it all in one place. And at that point, you are literally a hair's breadth away from implanting that thing into people's bodies.
Right. Okay, the next one. Are we close to technology reading our electromagnetic signature without chipping us? Or, for example, could something read my electromagnetic frequency balancing pendant and recognize my body's signature?
Well, you could do that if you were in a really perfect laboratory under perfect laboratory conditions. You could not do that on you know, the streets of Manhattan. You probably couldn't even do that in a normal room with normal just, you know, lamps plugged into the walls. So the short answer to that question is no, we're not there. The longer answer to that question is I'm sure that it's being worked on, but we've got a long way to go before we actually get there.
Okay, and then finally, Quicken Mint Financial Software and Web-based Financial Management Tool. Who handles their data? Is it really private, or is it like Google's Gmail? I heard Google scans everyone's email for marketing purposes. Is that true?
Yeah, I can't address Quicken. I have no clue. I can certainly address Google because that's my big latest thing. I went kind of supermarket cards to RFID to Google. here's the problem with Google. Google has the single largest database on individual people ever amassed in all of human history. Bar none, hands down.
I think the military and the intelligence agencies and NSA have something bigger.
I disagree. And to the extent they do, they obtained it from Google.
I say that
because we do not reveal the kinds of information that we reveal to Google in any other context. When we go into Google, we tell Google our health, our mental state, the state of our relationships, whether we're looking for drug counseling, whether we're looking up psychedelic substances, whether we're looking up rashes between our toes. Google knows everything about people who use it. And, in fact, they hire the most brilliant minds on earth to figure out how to learn more about people and how to infer things on the basis of their searches. And Google, believe me, is absolutely watching every shred of that. In addition, Google reads every single email that is sent or received and scans it for keywords or nouns and puts them into your profile. So they do this for marketing purposes. So if you say, hey, I'm looking forward to my vacation in Hawaii, they'll go, ah, Hawaii vacation, and you'll be on some other unrelated, you know, car repair website, and all of a sudden there's an ad for a Hawaii hotel. You go, how'd they know? They know because they're
right.
Reading your email. So Google has a dossier of information on every single person that uses its service. If you make the mistake of actually logging into Google, then God help you, because if you're actually using something like Google Calendar, Google Groups, Google Phone, any of these, Gmail, of course, any service where you're actually identifying yourself specifically, they're having a field day with you. The records that they have would put the records held by the Stasi in East Germany to shame, or the records held by the KGB.
Now, what search engine should we use?
Unbelievable. When I first found this out, I combed the globe, and I found a search engine that I'm in love with called StartPage.
StartPage.
Protecting Your Privacy, StartPage.com. They are based in the Netherlands, where there are very stringent privacy regulations. They've been certified by Europries, which is the European Certifying Authority, after a six-month privacy audit. I am now so in love with the company that I'm their U.S. spokesperson. I've broken bread with the founders of the company. I know them all very well. They're good people doing the right thing. And what I love about StartPage is they are a meta search engine. So when you type in your search, they go out to everybody but Google. They go to Yahoo and Bing and Quill and Ask and all those guys. Submit your query to 11 other search engines and bring you back the results without those search engines ever seeing you. So the nobody can make a record of what you're doing because StartPage doesn't record your searches or your IP address, and it's all private. So even if they got subpoenaed or hacked, there would be nothing to obtain because they don't keep the records. So I'm telling everybody, listen, if you are concerned about data, the number one thing you need to change in your life right this moment is stop using Google because Google is recording it. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, recently said on TV to Maria Bartiromo that if you don't want them to know what you're looking up, you probably shouldn't be looking it up. And he fully acknowledged that they record everything that you do, and if they got a Patriot Act request, they would turn it over to the government.
For sure. Okay, well, Catherine, I'm going to have to cut us off because I've run over, but I can't thank you enough. We're going to have you back later this year. There's more to talk about. And, again, if we want to support you, particularly you need $1,000, right, for the chipmenot.com. Is that it?
That is what we're looking for.
If people want to help, they can send a check. Is your address up on the
– Yeah, if you go to CatherineAlbrecht.com, my address should be there. My email is kma@spychips.com, and I would be more than happy to.
Okay, well, we're certainly going to be supporting your work here at Solari. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Catherine, and I really want to thank you for your many years of work, too.
Oh, listen, we're going to be in cahoots for a long time. I'm looking forward to great success here.
Okay,
ladies and gentlemen, let's go to movie. Opera is not for everyone, and Stravinsky is not for everybody who even loves opera. But I wanted to just point you towards, if you do love opera and you do like Stravinsky, I wanted to point you to this one particular creation of a rendition of The Nightingale of Rossignol. It's an amazing depiction of the use of digital technology and the dangers of that technology for central control. I love technology, but it's not always used wonderfully, and it's a great artistic rendition, again, if you love opera like Stravinsky. In closing, coming up, we have John Williams of ShadowStats, fabulous economist, on May 6th, talking about the real numbers on the real economy. It's a wonderful roadmap of what's really going on. May 13th, Precious Metals Market Report. We've got a huge article coming out next week, Solari Report on the Precious Metals ETFs, SLV and GLD. It's going to be initially published privately to the Solari Report and La Metropole Cafe subscribers, so stay tuned for that. And until then, just remember you're in our prayers. Don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.